Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Around the world, experts are now warning that the coronavirus pandemic could be an unprecedented, emotionally traumatic event. Trauma isn't uncommon following major crises like natural disasters, mass shootings, terrorist attacks, and health epidemics. But this pandemic could leave millions of people with post-traumatic stress disorder, from first responders on the ground, to those forced to quarantine at home, to people coming out of the ICU. For more on this, we spoke to clinical psychologist Deborah Kaysen. She is a professor with the Department of Psychiatry at Stanford University and also the president of the International Society for Traumatic Stress Studies. Deborah started by explaining what exactly PTSD is and told me about some of its common symptoms.
So PTSD is a reaction to going through extreme traumatic events, and it involves basically four clusters of symptoms. You can think about intrusive symptoms. Those are things like memories that you can't keep out of your head or nightmares. Avoidance symptoms. Those are things like trying not to think about it, trying to push those memories away. Hyperarousal symptoms. Those are things like feeling really watchful and on guard, having trouble concentrating, having problems with sleep. And then also changes in your mood or your way of making sense of the world.
Should we be differentiating now between being sort of formally diagnosed with PTSD and someone who listens to those symptoms you just enumerated and says, oh yeah, I feel that way right now?
One of the things about PTSD is we don't actually diagnose it right in the midst of a trauma because those kinds of reactions are really common and are really normal when we're going through horrible events. And so that means it's normal. Now, if somebody is still having these reactions in a few months, then it might be time to think about whether they're interfering with your life and getting in the way and reaching out for some help.
Who are the people who are most at risk for PTSD right now?
In what we're seeing from early reports around COVID-19 and also what we can learn from past epidemics like the SARS, MERS, and Ebola outbreaks, what we know is there are specific groups of people who are going to be most at risk. Frontline healthcare workers. They are working in very, very difficult situations, and they're a group that are already looking like they're at a high risk. If you lose a loved one, some of the pieces about how COVID-19 is interfering with normal grief processes, those folks may be more at risk. So people where there are losses, where they're exposed to sudden or unexpected death, where they're faced with moral dilemmas, people who are quarantined, especially involuntarily, those are some of the people that I might keep my eye on.
We've seen a little early research into trauma and healthcare workers in China from this pandemic. Is there anything that we're learning from that that has stood out?
It actually speaks very much to this issue about who is most at risk and what the rates are. So one early study has found that symptoms of depression are found in about 50% of healthcare workers. Anxiety is about 45%. General distress, sort of those PTSD symptoms, are being reported by about 70%, and insomnia by about a third of the healthcare workers.
Wow.
Nurses have been most at risk. Women are more at risk. I think in part it's a complicated issue, but sometimes we take on that role of taking care of other people, may not always take on the role of taking care of ourselves. Plus, women often are doing that dance around caring for family members and trying to deal with their jobs and feeling really torn and split.
Are there kind of internal red flags that we should look for in ourselves?
Yeah. So I would look for sleep disturbance. If you're really having trouble with concentrating, if you're having problem with a depressed mood, if you're having suicidal thoughts, those are places that are signs that you may need a little bit of extra help and support.
A lot of people have children at home right now and are trying to figure out ways to educate them and keep them safe and occupied. Are there differences in how kids experience the various symptoms of PTSD that parents should be looking for?
They look to us for their cues. So acknowledging how they're feeling, giving them a place to talk about it, also conveying messages that they're going to be okay. Those things can be helpful. Giving them accurate information that's developmentally appropriate for where they are, that's really important. Helping them find ways online to connect with their friends and their supports is also a way that we can help our kids be more resilient around all of this.
You mentioned people in involuntary quarantine, and look, being cooped up, no matter what the circumstances, are hard. But are there ways, if you are in involuntary quarantine, that you can try to kind of lower the stress burden on yourself?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And for some people, they're going to be at risk because they've got other stressors going on as well. Folks who've lost their jobs or are worried about family members being sick. But some of the things that people can do that can help, again, reaching out for social supports, even if it's in a virtual space, that can help people. I think doing a little bit of a mental shift as much as you can around seeing it from a loss framework to something that is more voluntary, something that we are doing for each other as a community to help keep each other safe and well, that mental shift can actually help us tolerate things that are hard in an easier way. And then using healthy coping, I know there's lots of talk about quarantinis, but in general, trying to balance alcohol use, reduce it. You know, if you're in a place where you can do a little bit of walking with physical distancing, you know, that can definitely be helpful.
You mentioned healthcare workers, and because I am expecting a child, I have had to interact with healthcare workers a lot. And one nurse told me that she had lost 4 colleagues to COVID-19, but that she still had to come in every day and do her job. And I guess I wonder, how do people parse that out in putting on their game face because they have to, and also finding a space to say, there is trauma here and I'm going to need to deal with it?
It is such a hard dilemma for people, especially the folks who are putting in 18-hour days to try to handle this. And I think exactly what you're talking about is what can help people the most. So some of it is not forgetting self-care, not forgetting, and it's easy to say, right? But taking 3 minutes to breathe, going out for a little bit of a walk and putting work aside, connecting with the people that you love in your life and connecting with the medical team that you work with. Those are all things that can help buffer people, social support, healthy coping strategies. But the other piece is when you're in the work, really focusing on why you're here and what you're doing. I also think leadership at institutions makes a huge difference. If people are feeling supported by the larger administration, the hospital system, they're going to be more resilient to coping with COVID-19 from a mental health perspective.
We've been talking sort of about the individual manifestations of trauma, but there are concerns about kind of wider collective trauma and grief. What does that look like?
I think we're still trying to understand some of that. Mm. You know, this is so unprecedented in terms of everyone on the planet going through an event like this together, especially in an age of social media where we can actually see each other's reactions around the globe. As a planet, we have a choice about whether we're going to see this as something collective where we can learn from and heal together versus something where we pit each other one against another. And as much as we can see this as a shared experience where we support each other, it will be better for all of us as human beings.
Are there lessons that we've learned from SARS or 9/11 or mass shootings about how to cope with a large crisis and the fact that people have different reactions to it?
There are definitely things that we can learn. I think, again, SARS, MERS, Ebola are probably the best proxies for us to understand, in part because they go on for a longer time. Mass shootings, 9/11, that was a collective trauma in many ways. We feel it as a country when this has happened. But for most people, it's a discrete event that then is over. And I say most people, because certainly for the first responders with 9/11, for the immediate survivors, the after effects go on for years.
Sure.
But what we can understand from some of the other epidemics and pandemics that have happened are there are strategies that can be useful. There's actually a package of intervention strategies. You can think about it almost as tools for recovery and resilience called psychological first aid. Much of it was developed following the tsunamis and trying to understand how to best support people. And it has things like noticing what your immediate needs are and attending to those. And then noticing things like your need for social support or how you're doing with coping and making a shift from maybe less effective strategies around coping to more effective strategies around coping. The other piece around it also is recognizing that we all have different ways of responding and that these are all normal and natural reactions and that most people actually will recover over time.
What are hospitals doing right now to help workers fight that kind of trauma?
One of the things that for me has been a silver lining around this has been watching how some of the healthcare systems are responding and watching sharing of resources across institutions. So a number of universities, academic medical centers, healthcare systems are actually rolling out in various ways psychological first aid for their healthcare workforce. So Stanford, for example, has been creating emotional support groups for trainees, for physicians, for nursing staff that people can attend as much as they need or want. And I've seen this across multiple institutions as ways to buffer and protect and take care of their healthcare workforce.
Therapy, psychological help can be expensive. Often if you have health insurance, it isn't even covered. Are there ways that people can do this kind of work for themselves for little to no cost?
There's a great app that was developed by the VA called the PTSD Coach. It's free. It doesn't actually collect or keep your data, doesn't share it with anyone. It has things like, how do I improve my sleep? I'm feeling really stressed out. What's a breathing exercise I can do? I'm noticing my thoughts might be a little extreme. Are there any tools I can use? They've also got a website that will walk you through the skills if you don't have a smartphone. So things like that are great resources. Yeah. There's another one that's the Mindfulness Coach that'll help take you through some guided meditation. The other thing I would say, though, is, you know, PTSD is very treatable. We have brief interventions that are highly effective for PTSD that are usually about 9 to 15 sessions. So this is not something where someone would need to be in therapy for years and years necessarily to recover. But I agree with what you're saying. It can be hard to find those providers. It can be expensive. It might be out of network. Or you might live someplace where it's hard to find those people.
Deborah Kaysen is a professor with the Department of Psychiatry at Stanford University and also the president of the International Society for Traumatic Stress Studies. Thank you so much for talking with me.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
And if you or someone you know is struggling or having thoughts of suicide, you can call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 800-273-8255 or the NAMI helpline at 800-950-NAMI. That's 6264. This is The Takeaway, back in a minute.